KALW.
A quarter of all schools, 400 districts, reported identifying exactly zero homeless students. That simply could not be possible.
Federally guaranteed educational rights for homeless students are under the microscope.
What we found is that local schools are completely under-identifying students who are experiencing homelessness. Staff are not being appropriately trained. Public information is not being disseminated.
Then we'll turn to Uncuffed and see how incarcerated people get through the holidays in prison.
Christmas time, it's really a sad time to be in the penitentiary. I'm going to let y'all know that now. But when Bun cooked up that meal, I started to call my mother and tell her she has a rival. You know what I'm saying? It was so good. And it just kind of took me back to a time when innocence was there. You know, and a lot of times innocence is lost in here.
I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. More than a quarter million California public school students are homeless that we know about. And when education reporter Lee Romney joined us at KALW more than 2 years ago, that's the story she dug into first. She learned that not having a fixed address really impacts how kids fare in the classroom. And she introduced us to this 10-year-old boy and his mom.
It's 6 a.m., but Nassim's 22 miles and three counties away from his school.
Is your grandma sleeping?
Yeah, she's sleeping.
Okay. Yeah, so I figured you guys have to be kind of quiet.
After they'd lost their housing, they moved into Nassim's great-grandma's one-bedroom apartment in South San Francisco, and he and his mom commuted 4 hours a day by foot and on BART so he could stay in the Oakland Unified School that knew and cared about him.
All right, so we got to start our journey. Okay.
It turned out Nassim's mom didn't know that federal law guarantees homeless students help with transportation costs to and from school and a lot more. Staff at Nassim's school were in the dark, too. They didn't realize they were supposed to flag the district about Nassim's housing situation. Well, those were not isolated problems. A recent state audit found districts across California are undercounting their homeless students. And Lee is back here with me to talk about it. Hi, Lee.
Hello, Hannah.
So tell us about this federal law.
It's called the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act, and it's actually been around for more than three decades. So students with unstable housing are way more likely to miss school and drop out. So this law was designed to guarantee them educational stability. Mm-hmm. And what that looks like, you know, school districts are required to cover transportation costs so homeless kids can stay in the same school like mm-hmm. Nassim. And they're also supposed to provide school supplies and tutoring and connect families to food pantries and potentially to housing. And so it's quite a bit.
Okay. So are we talking about students who are sleeping outside or in shelters, or who are we talking about?
Well, actually, the U.S. Department of Education's definition is much broader than that. It also considers students homeless if they're living in a motel or doubled up with other families because of hardship, or like Nassim, sleeping on a relative's floor.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about the California audit. What did it set out to do?
Well, for starters, to dig into the homeless student numbers and figure out why there seemed to be an undercount.
So someone already suspected there was an undercount.
Yes. Uh-huh. Three assembly members, including San Francisco Democrat David Chu, requested this audit. And Chu told me he knew something was wrong with last year's data.
It showed that a quarter of all schools, 400 districts, reported identifying exactly zero homeless students. Several of my legislative colleagues and I knew that simply could not be possible given the intense housing and homelessness crisis we're seeing.
So that's nearly 2,700 schools, and a lot of them are in urban areas with super high housing costs, all reporting zero.
Okay, very suspicious. What did the audit find?
Well, the state auditor picked five districts and one charter high school to really drill down on, and they were chosen to reflect California geographically and demographically. Mm-hmm. Four of these six places, it turned out, had identified a very small number of students as homeless, well below what experts say districts should expect. So the audit explored why. Here's Chu again.
What we found is that local schools are completely under-identifying students who are experiencing homelessness. Best practices are not being followed. Staff are not being appropriately trained. public information's not being disseminated.
And the audit found the California Department of Education isn't doing a good job making sure that districts comply with the federal law, McKinney-Vento.
Mm-hmm. And did it identify anything districts were doing right?
Actually, yes, through a pretty interesting comparison. So Vallejo City Unified School District, the only Bay Area district in the mix, had a likely undercount. But meanwhile, an L.A. County district that matches up demographically with Vallejo identified 9 times as many of its economically disadvantaged students as homeless.
9 times. Why? Do we know?
Well, it turns out that L.A. County district dedicates way more staff hours to its McKinney-Vento program than Vallejo. Mm. And the audit also found it does more to get students and families services by collaborating with nonprofits. And lo and behold, students identified as homeless in that district had much higher graduation rates and lower absenteeism rates than Vallejo's.
So McKinney-Vento requires outreach to families. What does that look like?
Well, for starters, districts need to give families a questionnaire at least annually that asks delicately about their housing situation.
Delicately? How does that? Because I would imagine a lot of the underreporting or undercounting has to do with people just, you know, being embarrassed and not coming out and saying they are without a home.
Yeah, there's such a stigma. And this definition is so broad that sometimes families don't define themselves that way.
Right.
So one of the things they checked is don't use the word homeless.
Uh-huh.
So to try to ascertain, are families, do they have a fixed address? Are they moving around a lot? That still qualifies you.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So 2 districts in the audit weren't even doing a questionnaire. And the law, in addition to the questionnaire, also requires districts to put up posters about families' legal rights under this law in places like shelters and food pantries and laundromats, mm-hmm. just letting them know that this law exists and that they have rights, you know, and not to be afraid to report.
Right.
So only 1 district was doing that. And they're supposed to, you know, make sure that all school teachers and administrators are trained in addition to cafeteria workers and other support staff, so they all know when to refer a family or unaccompanied youth to the district's McKinney-Vento office. Mm-hmm. And the audit found that a lot of school staff didn't seem to know much, if anything, about the law.
So what kind of changes might come out of this audit?
Well, on the state level, the audit recommends the California Department of Ed improve its oversight in a big way, as well as its training and its support of districts.
Okay. And how about Nassim and his mom? How are they doing?
Well, Nassim is now part of Oakland Unified's homeless count, and they've gotten some help with bus passes, and they're on a subsidized housing wait list now mm-hmm. in Solano County, but still. Nassim's in 7th grade now okay. in an Oakland Unified middle school. But the bad news is they still don't have stable housing. So they've bounced around a lot. And mom told me Nassim's grades have suffered quite a bit during those transitions.
Mm. All right. Well, thank you, Lee.
Thank you.
Lee Romney's KALW's education reporter. You can reach her at education@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. For a lot of people in prison, the holiday season is a painful time. You miss your family and your traditions, but it's also a time when people come together to make the best of their situation with food and acts of kindness. We're about to hear the last episode of the first season of Uncuffed, our show recorded and produced inside Solano and San Quentin prisons. For today's finale, we're going to hear from the guys at both institutions and find out how they get through the holidays.
So we're going to start out here at Solano State Prison, and I'm going to let you know who's in the room.
Steve Drown.
Oh, you're pointing at me. B.F. Timms. Call me Brian if you want.
Joe Kirk.
I'm Brian Mazza.
And I'm Damon Cook. Welcome to Uncuffed.
You know, the holiday season, it reminds me of a lot of family. Something I really did with my life is I screwed up a lot, and my family doesn't talk to me anymore. And it made me put everything in perspective and realize, wow, I'm really really missing out on a lot. You know, like even though I don't really believe in traditions and I'm not really a faithful person, it's still like I still kind of miss that gathering around with the people I'm familiar with.
A lot of people do have their families. In my case, my family's back in Iowa. I haven't seen them in 45 years. I haven't experienced a Christmas or Thanksgiving with them in years and years. And then I sit there at night and I watch TV and I see these come at home moments, even if it's for a bank advertisement or something, where somebody comes home that hasn't been there for years. And I want that to be me, but I can't have that. We had a group of guys about 3 or 4 years ago who were crocheting animals and taking them out to the visiting room to give to the kids at Christmas. And they called themselves the Secret Santas.
And they still do that.
They still do that. And it was so funny to see these big bikers and giants sitting in a room crocheting. You know, they're tacked back and they're crocheting. And it was one of the most incredible sights you could ever see. A lot of us give of ourselves in some way, something we have, something we can share, some knowledge, whatever it is. And we don't want the accolades. We don't want the acknowledgement.
That's the gist of the whole thing, is being able to experience that peace and the love and the camaraderie and whatever else. And, you know, as the year goes by, being away from my family in prison, it really hurt a lot. And I lost the meaning of spirituality. And I figured out later on that it wasn't about what I got. It was about, you know, what I did or the way I thought or how I took my place here in prison as far as me representing my family's love from in here. How best can I respect them by the things that I do and the things that I say? It makes a big difference. I don't feel so lonely. I don't feel so isolated anymore. I feel as if I'm with my family.
I think for me, there's a couple of things that I like to do during these times, one of which is I like to cook for others. I like to be of service.
So that's coming up, right?
What's that?
The cooking for others.
Yes, it's coming up soon for all you. Right. Wait, stand by.
Are you going to cook in here for us?
Yes, I'm going to cook for you guys.
Oh, then you may continue your story.
Okay, thank you for that. So anyway, what I try to do is I think about the guys who are less fortunate, and I look around the building, and I see some guys that I know that possibly haven't gotten anything to eat or any food for the month. And so what I try to do is I try to reach out to them unbeknownst to them. So I go and I gather all the food up, and then I cook for them. And then on Christmas Day, I serve them with bowls. And the only thing that they're required to do is give me their bowl. And then I look out for them.
It's hard to give in here because a lot of people, they don't understand generosity. They think that kindness is weakness.
Yeah.
And it's difficult sometimes.
Yo, B, why haven't you bought into this Christmas thing?
I just don't, because for me, I've had a trigger, and I mentioned this when I went to my first board hearing. I've had a trigger in my past that might still be lingering, and that had to do with authority figures, right? And the authority figures that came from going to church and having a religious, ultra-religious Pentecostal background. So saying that I had to believe something or I had to do something and do it unquestioning, that's always been a problem for me. Damon, look like you're about to say something.
No, I didn't want to call it a holiday. I didn't want to call it spiritual. I just know that there's something that resonates in us all. And what we call it is what we call it. But each person has spoke on different things in this room today that lets me know personally that there's something bigger and greater than us that lives in us all.
Just to make my point, at least one time, have you seen me in the year and a half that you've been here, you know, working together, and have you been glad to see me?
Never. No. No, I'm always glad to see everybody.
That's a holiday. See, I know Steve gets really happy to see me. Oh, but the point I'm making, I continue to make, that is genuine to me. That's festivities. That's personal reason to celebrate. That's meaningful to me, man. That's the stuff that makes me mushy, you know, inside. That's the stuff that you see the hard exterior just dissolve and I won't give a damn. You know, you'll know that I care about being part of the human race.
And I choose to call what you just said God.
I just want to say one other thing, guys.
Does it jump out at you?
42 years, I can't think of six better guys to spend the holidays with. We are a band of brothers. We have our differences. We have our disagreements. But we also have a love and respect for each other that goes far beyond anything else. And that is the biggest gift. And shut up, Brian.
You're going to make me cry.
I know it, damn it. But I come in here every day, and I know that I've got six guys who have my back.
All right, thank you, Steve.
My six.
I appreciate that.
That's my present.
You know
thanks,
what? Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
I think screw Christmas. I'm going to make my New Year's resolution to get Steve a freaking girlfriend.
All right. Thank you.
Good luck with that. Go ahead.
All right, guys. Look, that's it for us over here. We're going to throw things over to San Quentin now to hear what they have to say about the holidays and with the spirituality and all the things that we talked about. We're going to see what they're talking about.
All right. So this is Greg Eschridge once again. From the San Quentin side of Uncuffed, here we are at the round table with the fellas. So let me see, let me look around. Who I got with me today? Bun, sitting right next to me. What's up, Bun?
Hey, how you doing? This is me.
What's up, Shakur?
All is well, man. Taking it one day at a time. Staying focused.
And how you doing today, Nate?
Man, I can't complain. All is well.
All is well?
All is well.
What's on your mind when it comes to the around this time of the year?
I've been incarcerated 34 years, and I don't celebrate the holidays. You know, at one point, I did celebrate the holidays when I was a kid growing up in the household, family being a Baptist minister, a Christian. But today, you know, I practice Islam. However, what I do appreciate about it is all of my family members, they like meet up over the holidays. They fly in from the different parts of the United States, and I'm able to call them and have an opportunity to speak to people who I haven't spoken to, you know, for like a few years maybe. So for me right now, it's just about being able to connect with my family members.
Matter of fact, how long have you been practicing Islam?
I've been practicing Islam since 1993. One thing I want to say, as a person who identifies as Muslim, like, I'm not locked inside a box. For me, dimensions of God or Allah go far beyond brackets, right? So when I think of, like, Christmas and I think of my conversion to Islam and whatnot, like, it was a transition that I had to go through. Those spiritual principles, like the spirit of giving, like, that's something that I definitely subscribe to. Like, that's a part of my faith, like charity and being charitable. As a matter of fact, that's one of the pillars of Islam.
That's what's up, man. You know, I think rather, irregardless of your faith, whatever you may believe in, you know, I think Christmas is just about love. And there's so many atrocities that are taking place across the world. And I think we all need a break from it. Mm-hmm. You know, just a time where somebody, where we could just say, thank you. Yeah. I love you. I appreciate you. Like one of my best friends, fiance, wife, actually, every Christmas, she sends me a Christmas card. And she specifically always makes it a black Santa Claus because I'm black, right? Yeah. So I always trip on that. I remember the first time she sent the card, she sent me it was a black Santa Claus, right? Yeah. And so I had a Christmas card that I was going to send her, but it had a white Christmas white Santa Claus, right? So I was like, man, I can't send a white Santa Claus.
You know, for me, my mother worked at Lockheed Electronics, but on the side, she baked cakes as a side hustle, and she was very good at it, like decorating wedding cakes and special occasions, birthday cakes and mold cakes, doll cakes. I mean, she was real good at that. So by the time I was like 9 years old, I was tired of licking the bowl and the beaters, you know? But when I think about the desserts, man, at Thanksgiving time that my mother used to put together, it leaves a just a warm feeling, you know, because we need warm feelings in here because the pies and desserts here compared to mama is busted, right? You know? But that's what I really miss the most, man, is smelling that sweet potato pie and that pecan pie just permeating all through the house and waking you up. And you say, I can't wait to get a slice of that. That's what I did. What do you think, Bun?
On the holidays here, man, it's kind of sad around here. And I've been in prison for 23 years. So, you know, for me, I like to cook on holidays, Thanksgiving, any holiday.
But you can cook.
thank you, Nate. I mean, last year, Greg said, I need a spread. So I was like, okay, Greg, we're going to do this. But he said, oh, it's going to be seafood. So I was like, let's go. So Greg and the fellas brought some oysters, clams, some fish, rice. And, you know, I brought some of my special seasoning. I can't tell you guys that.
Well, that's a secret.
I can't give you my secret. You know, and we whipped it up right here, and everybody loved it. And that's one of my joys during the holidays, to help the fellas out. And, you know, we get together and we cook, and everybody just have a ball.
Around Christmas time, it's really a sad time to be in the penitentiary. I'm going to let y'all know that now. There ain't no bones about it. It's not cool. But when Bun cooked up that meal, hooked up that meal, I started to call my mother and tell her she has a rival. You know what I'm saying? It was so good. And it kind of took me back to a time when innocence was there. You know, a lot of times innocence is lost in here. But it was one of those things that we got together and everybody seemed like they participated, they brought something. It really helped me get through a difficult time, and a difficult time for me is the holidays. The holidays are very difficult because we're missing our family, we're missing our parents, our children, our sisters, our brothers, mm-hmm. you know, aunties and uncles that we haven't seen in years. What the saying is, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you with. That's what we're doing around
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely.
You know,
and we do a good job of it too, man. That's one thing I can say. We all come together, pitch in, because it's tough for all of us.
I like cooking for everybody on the holidays because, you know, Christmas is some people say is religious, and some people is all about just Santa Claus and stuff like that. But for me, it's personal because my younger son was born on Christmas Eve, and when he was born, I was already in jail, and I didn't find out that he was born on Christmas Eve until the 2nd of the following year, because we couldn't get the phones right in LA in the county jail. So for me, cooking on especially Christmas, like I cook for Ton and them, and it makes me feel like I'm with my son, because he's around their age. So when I get ready and cook for him and cook for the fellas, like me celebrating his birthday, because I always said that was my the only Christmas gift I ever wanted, and I don't need no other Christmas gift. And until this day, he's 22 now. He's my favorite Christmas present, and if I never got another one, it'll be fine. So, you know, cooking for the fellas on Christmas means a lot to me. And it's like celebrating the birth of my son, Nicholas. And, you know, and we all get together like family here.
Years ago, I went to the store. It was around Christmas time, mm-hmm. and I went to the store, and I bought like a lot of food, like roast beef and chili beans and rice and a lot of different items. And I put them in a big brown bag. And I came out on Christmas Day early in the morning, and I said to myself, the very first person that walks past me and says Merry Christmas, I'm gonna give them that bag. Yeah. And lo and behold, I walked outside. I walked past a few people. Nobody said anything, right? Everybody said, hey, what's up? But nobody said Merry Christmas. I got downstairs and I was going outside, and this old white dude, he said, Merry Christmas, brother.
Wow.
I said, Merry Christmas, man. And I said, here you go. He said, what's this? I said, this is Merry Christmas. That's what it is. I said, it's your Christmas gift, a big bag of food. And he looked at that and looked at me like, damn, like what's going on? Like he didn't even expect it. But to the point about Christmas and giving, man, that's what it's about. And you know what? Think of that story. I might do that again this year, man.
Merry Christmas, Greg.
Merry Christmas, Greg.
I said it first.
Yeah, man. So, wait, before we go, I wanna tell my children, I apologize to y'all for not being there, for missing Christmases, and especially this time of year. And I just want to say that I'm sorry, and I love y'all.
That was an excerpt from the last episode of Uncuffed, Season 1. It was made by the crews at Solano and San Quentin State Prisons. Shout out to all the participants, Chanton Bunn, Damon Cook, Steve Drown, Greg Eskridge, Joe Kirk, Spoon Jackson, Brian Mazza, Nate McKinney, Edmund Richardson, Tommy Shakur Ross, Brian Thames, and Ton Tran. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best best of their ability. All content is approved by an information officer. Stay tuned for the next season. You can stay updated with our newsletter at weareuncuffed.org and make sure to subscribe to Uncuffed on any podcast player. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sona Avakian, Janae Darden, Christopher Agusa, Nina Gensler-Debs, True Gwynn, Kristen McCandless, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Jessica Plachik, Andrew Stelzer, Eli Wirtschafter, and Tiana Williams. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tadek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Dawood Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.